President Biden is putting the U.S. back in the Paris Climate Agreement. After 4 years of obstructing international climate efforts, that'll just be the first step to getting back in the club.
I do think there's a credibility issue and a trust issue with the United States.
Also today, President Biden signs an order for more masks that work better against the coronavirus.
We dropped the ball. It didn't have to be just N95s. We have, for example, technical specifications for how to make the cloth masks better.
And looking back on Wuhan 1 year after lockdown, a mix of accomplishment and anger.
I want the officials who concealed the epidemic and didn't act to be held accountable.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. On his first full day in office, President Biden aimed to tackle the coronavirus pandemic head on. The president is signing 10 more executive orders at the White House this afternoon.
Today, I am unveiling a national strategy on COVID-19 and executive actions to beat this pandemic. This plan reflects the ideas I set forward during the campaign and further refined over the past 3 months.
Today's executive orders include directives for clear federal guidance on how and when to safely reopen schools. Team Biden is also addressing shortages of the vaccine and PPE supplies, including the need for more surgical masks, swabs, and pipettes used in testing. The moves Biden is taking today follow yesterday's slew of day one orders. One of those changes was presented today by Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, directly to the World Health Organization.
I am honored to announce that the United States will remain a member of the World Health Organization.
Fauci said the U.S. would work to strengthen and reform the WHO.
The United States sees technical collaboration at all levels as a fundamental part of our relationship with WHO, one that we value deeply and will look to strengthen going forward.
WHO Director Tedros Ghebreyesus responded today on Twitter that the WHO is a family of nations and that he is glad the U.S. is staying in the family. It feels like a lifetime ago now, but it was a year ago this week when the city of Wuhan, China was put under lockdown. That lasted 76 days. The World's Rebecca Kanther headed back to Wuhan to see how the city is recovering and how people there look back on that dark time. As she found out, two very different narratives have emerged.
A year ago, I passed through Wuhan, just before the lockdown went into effect. More than 3,000 people died of the virus here, but there hasn't been a case in Wuhan since last spring. I wanted to return to see how the city has recovered. First stop, this sprawling exhibition hall. It used to be a temporary hospital for COVID patients. Today, it's a museum documenting the city's fight against the virus. It's strange to walk through a museum about a threat that is still very real for so many people, even here. Outside, large banners feature faces of frontline workers. And giant Chinese characters read, "The people and life above all else." Inside, a massive screen displays China's leader Xi Jinping larger than life, praising the response to the pandemic. There's a timeline of what the government did and when, and photos and videos showing the actions of top leaders. The heart of the exhibition is a recreation of the hospital ward that stood at this very spot. A 3D hologram shows hospital workers in full protective gear fighting to save their patients' lives. Hospital cots are set up as if still in use. Tour guides lead visitors through the hall, filled with drawings made by patients, even an ambulance. Visitors can lay virtual flowers in front of small black and white photos of COVID-19 martyrs, including Li Wenliang, one of the doctors who warned about the virus early on and was punished for doing so. Of course, that part was left out. College student Zhao Xingyu says he traveled from Beijing to see for himself how Wuhan has recovered.
I
feel like they gave so much. So many people from the top government leaders down to each volunteer really pitched in to help out, he says. One of the videos shows Wuhan residents saying farewell to the medical teams who came from all over China to help out, with a song playing in the background called Let Me Thank You. Then the mood lifts, and one last display shows Wuhan's vibrant street life, everything back to normal. The message is clear. The government led the city out of the crisis. Not everyone feels that way, though. I talked to a few people here who say their lives can never go back to normal. Last January, Youngmin's 24-year-old daughter went to the hospital for chemo treatment. Then she got a fever. Doctors said she was getting better, but she died of COVID shortly after. Because Yang was also sick, she didn't learn of her daughter's death until weeks later. She's angry at what she calls a cover-up. I want justice for my daughter, she says. I want the officials who concealed the epidemic and didn't act to be held accountable. This is my only reason to live now. Like everyone who's lost a family member to the virus, Yang was offered just under $500 compensation. She refused it and has been trying to sue the government ever since. The courts won't take her case. After she visited the local government office to complain, the police came. The next day, they restricted my personal freedom and prevented me from going outside my apartment complex, she says. They changed my health code color from green to red and said I couldn't go out. Zhang Hai is also trying to sue. A year ago, he brought his 76-year-old father to Wuhan for hip surgery. Within 15 days, his father contracted COVID and died. Zhang is racked with guilt. I sent my father to his death, he says. Zhang thinks the government needs to be held accountable for its mismanagement in the early days. The virus broke out because of the government's underreporting, he says. That killed people. How can you praise yourself for later actions? What matters most is what you did at the beginning. But a year after the lockdown, voices like Zhang Hai's and Youngmin's are not welcome. They say they are under surveillance. They've been blocked from social media and have been called into the police numerous times. Local journalists can't publish interviews with them. There are others here in Wuhan who just want to put that difficult time behind them. This busy brew pub is packed with customers, drinking, laughing, masks off. Hu Zhenghong is having a beer with a couple of friends. He says that going through the lockdown brought people together. I ask him if he feels like Wuhan is back to normal. Well, 80% really, he says. As long as you have your health and your life, that's the most important. He and his friends just want to enjoy themselves. Others tell me there's a feeling of anxiety bubbling beneath the surface. No one wants to let down their guard too much. Some are hoarding food to prepare for a second wave. Zhou Zhu, a young office worker, says he's anxious about a potential second lockdown now that there's another outbreak in Hebei province. But there's a vaccine now, and we've learned from our experience last year, so we're not as worried as we were then, he says. The people of Wuhan want to move on, but until the pandemic ends, it seems they will always have to be on alert. For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Almost a year into this pandemic, I have two questions for you. Do you wear a mask? And if so, what is it made of? If the answer to the first question is yes, I'm betting the answer to the second question for many of you is cloth. Cloth masks were supposed to be stopgap measures in the early months of the pandemic, as manufacturing was ramped up to make more effective masks for the general population. So what happened? Why are so many of us still wearing cloth masks? Zeynep Tufekci is with me to answer that. She's a sociologist and writer at the University of North Carolina. Her current article in The Atlantic is called Why Aren't We Wearing Better Masks? Zeynep, what's the answer to that?
We dropped the ball, and it doesn't have to be just N95s. We have, for example, technical specifications for how to make the cloth masks better using three layers of specific material. But it's not the kind of thing we should expect people to produce at home. Even for cloth masks or surgical masks or braces to make those masks fit better, we needed leadership and production and certification and more supply. And unfortunately, we didn't get any of it last year, and I'm hoping this will change soon.
I still see people wearing like a single ply cotton bandana. Is a cloth mask still better than no mask at all?
Absolutely. Any mask is better than no mask. To be honest, even a single layer bandana, if that's all they've got, that is so much better than not wearing a mask for preventing infecting other people. But if you want to protect yourself at a higher grade, especially if the people around you are wearing flimsy masks or no masks, what you want to wear is an N95 or a surgical mask with a brace to make it fit better, or a three-layer cloth mask with the kind of wire around the nose that makes it fit better. So there are all these things that are better for protecting you. And the fact that some people don't wear masks or they just wear flimsy masks makes it even more important for the people who are wearing masks and doing their part to have better masks to protect themselves better.
Zeynep, you say the U.S. dropped the ball on getting quality masks widely distributed. Other countries have quality masks widely available. Which countries got this right, and why or how were they able to do it?
They didn't drop the ball like us is sort of the quickest answer. In places like Taiwan, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, you see the government stepping up very early, distributing better quality masks. And as I said, you don't have to have the whole population wear N95s. You know, for example, in Taiwan, they used a lot more surgical masks. Or in Singapore, they have these, you know, six-layer cloth masks they've been distributing. But an important difference between the places that are wearing those masks and us is that we have rampant spread. Once you have this much spread, it's kind of like we're all like in a hospital, right? The way hospital workers wear higher grade protection because they're dealing with infected people all the time. With this much spread in the community in a country like ours, we have to kind of act like that when we go someplace, especially if it's indoors, because there's so many infected people around us. So not only have we dropped the ball behind places that started much earlier, because of that, we actually desperately need better masks now.
The Biden administration is addressing masks in executive orders today, for example, requiring them on planes and trains, also addressing supply shortfalls. How quickly, Zeynep, do you see these two things happening, and what will be the impact?
Well, the mandate clearly goes into effect immediately. That's fine. I think one of the things we could immediately do, even as we ramp up production, which we should have started a year ago, but here we are, is to have access to similar or equivalent standards from other countries in a way we can trust. Europe, China, Korea, they all have standards for higher grade masks that we could purchase. But when I try to purchase one online, I have no idea what I'm getting. Even just clarifying that, making that available in trusted channels, say pharmacies, so I could just walk in and purchase with confidence an equivalent standard from another country. I think that would go a long way as a first step while we increase our own production.
Zeynep Tufekci at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on technology and society. Pretty basic technology mask, Zeynep. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's kind of weird that we're discussing it a year later, but here we are.
Coming up next, a new strain of coronavirus is testing South Africa. And later on the show, Cesar Chavez and why his likeness now sits in the Oval Office. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. More than a third of Africa's COVID-19 cases have been in South Africa. Now that new variant of the coronavirus has arrived in the country and cases there are surging. But so far, South Africa has yet to start a vaccination program. Dr. Richard Lessels is an infectious disease expert in Durban. Paint us a picture, if you would, of life right now in South Africa during the pandemic. What are things like?
Well, it's been an extremely difficult last few weeks. As you mentioned, we saw this very rapid resurgence in cases in most parts of the country. And that's really come with a lot of deaths again. And so I think it's really hit home to people, the severity of this second wave that we've seen throughout the country. What we are seeing in the past few days is a downturn in the new infections. And in some places that started to kind of reflect even in a slight slowing of the hospitalizations and things. So we're seeing some first signs of kind of promising downturn, but it's still obviously early.
And this new variant of the coronavirus in South Africa, earlier this week, South African experts said that this new variant is 50% more contagious than the original strain. How does that affect the government's strategy in tackling the virus overall?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to note that 50% is an estimate from some mathematical modeling done by a team at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And it comes with quite a wide range of uncertainty. So we don't know for sure how much more transmissible it is, but we've clearly seen the reality of how easily this virus spread. And I think all that really tells us is how much more difficult it is to control when you've got a virus that's even more transmissible than what we saw at the beginning of the epidemic.
Meantime, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently said the country has secured 20 million doses of vaccine that's supposed to be delivered in the first half of this year. It appears, though, there's no detailed timeline for that, and that seems worrisome. What are your concerns?
It is worrying, but I think there's a lot of movement on that in the last couple of weeks and more concrete plans coming through and more ideas about what the strategy is. But like with every country, it's going to be a monumental challenge to roll out this vaccine in the wider population. The priority is obviously the initial tranche of vaccines to the frontline healthcare workers, and that we're optimistic is coming very soon and not before time. But I think there's still a lot that we have to understand about the wider rollout and how that will actually work.
Dr. Lessels, I'm wondering, with the new Biden administration and Dr. Anthony Fauci in conversation with the WHO today, what kind of encouragement does that give you that the global effort to beat the pandemic will be more muscular now and just have a greater impact on countries like South Africa?
Yeah, very welcome and very important. And it's clearly important that everybody recognizes how critical the WHO is in coordination of efforts around the world, and also in what they've been pushing recently, this push to ensure equity in access to vaccines and things. We need the WHO to be leading on all these things. And so it's great to see all countries now supporting the WHO.
Dr. Richard Lessels is an infectious disease expert. He's been speaking with us from Durban, South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Across the globe, WhatsApp is one of the most popular platforms for communicating with people. The messaging service was bought by Facebook in 2014, but now, after a change to WhatsApp's privacy policy, millions of users are dumping the service. They're moving largely to Signal, an alternative texting platform. Signal has gained so many new followers in such a short amount of time that its servers actually crashed. Wafa Ben-Hassin has been following this. She's a human rights lawyer focusing on global tech policy with the Omidyar Network. Wafa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start with the basics? Like, what happened here, the changes of the privacy policy, and how WhatsApp users reacted to the news?
January 15, 2021, after a lot of outrage on the internet, mostly because these privacy policy changes were not very understandable to users, WhatsApp announced that they're delaying the rollout of the new privacy policy until May 15th, saying that they're giving users more time, but actually not letting them opt out still. So in the meantime, we've seen a lot of users, millions of users, actually migrate to Signal. And there's good reason for that. But we still have yet to understand what these changes really look like.
It sounds really complex and kind of messy, all these back and forths. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. Well, actually, what's important to realize here is that the new privacy policy is not the easiest to understand. What is being shared exactly and under what format, whether, for instance, it's encrypted or not, whether the contacts that they'll be sharing with Facebook's are associated with names or not, is not really clear. And in addition to what data is shared, they also are not very clear about what that means when you're interacting with a business and when. So users are rightfully confused. And in addition to that, I mean, WhatsApp is the application that stood for and really marketed itself as a pro-privacy choice for billions of users worldwide. And so handing over any type of data to an external company, even if it's its parent company, understandably comes as a shock to users.
As I said, Signal's getting so much business that their servers crashed recently. It seems they've addressed that. But I'm just wondering, is this going to be one of those migration patterns where Signal will solve everyone's problems, at least for a little while, and then there will be something else that prompts everyone to migrate to another platform?
Well, it's actually really interesting because the ideal situation is that WhatsApp would reconsider and would not be engaging in this type of practice. But I mean, it remains to be seen. Like I said earlier, hopefully we could have more competitors in the space. We could have users actually choose where they what application they want to use to talk to their loved ones and to families and to businesses.
What about the WhatsApp users who are quitting the platform, but say other family members may stay on it to communicate? I mean, that seems like it could get problematic. And maybe for family harmony, they'll be forced to decide which platform to use. Have you heard anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, we see it in the closest people to us. I myself am trying to get my family to move to Signal, but does it really matter when other members of my family are on WhatsApp and their contacts are shared? And so therefore, my contact information is shared anyway. I think it's really, really tricky for users, and we're not being put in a good position or a good situation. And this just goes to show, I think it's anecdotal because it shows that users don't really have the choice. You're kind of being forced to use WhatsApp, whether you like it or not.
Could this whole episode impact how WhatsApp operates in the future, or maybe guide how Signal does business?
I think Signal is a different question because they're not there to make a bottom line. It is a nonprofit, and so they don't operate for profit-motivated reasons. But I think Facebook needs to come to terms about what it considers fair game in making a bottom line. They have to rethink their business model. You know, how will that company operate without pushing messages from the extreme come to the fore? And we're hoping that eventually the company will listen to some of the ideas that are on the table.
Wafa Ben-Hassin is a human rights lawyer focusing on global tech policy with the Omidyar Network. Wafa, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
More stories from around the globe still ahead for you this hour. We'll be right back. You're with the world. Spain has a generous new paternity leave policy. The hope is that it's not just a holiday for daddies, it's a time for them to change the diapers.
When you give men paternity leave and it's well paid, they take it and they get involved in childcare.
Also ahead, Biden's Iraq policy. Will today's suicide bombing in Baghdad change anything? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Joe Biden yesterday signed an executive order to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. The U.S. re-entry will be official in 30 days. But after 4 years of obstructing international climate efforts, that will be just the first step toward regaining the world's trust. That's this week on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
As we look at climate change solutions, how does the U.S. reposition itself as a global leader on climate action? The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
The Obama administration joined the Paris Agreement officially in 2016. President Trump announced he'd pull the plug the following year.
There's a feeling that is like whiplash.
Claire Healy works on climate diplomacy at the European environmental think tank E3G.
1 minute they're in, then they're out, then they're in. And that just undermines, I think, trust and that they'll be able to do what they say they're going to do on a long-term basis.
And that's a problem. The Paris Agreement is built on trust and a healthy dose of peer pressure. It doesn't legally bind countries to cut planet warming emissions. So for the system to work, experts say the U.S. has to regain that important trust.
Rejoining the Paris Agreement is the bare minimum.
This is former Colombian climate negotiator Isabel Cavalier.
And there is a lot of expectation on what will come with a big change in administration and policy.
Cavalier says one of those expectations is about money.
The U.S. is part of the developed countries that committed under the Paris Agreement to provide finance to developing countries.
Finance to help developing countries adapt to the impacts of climate change and switch to greener energy. The U.S. is currently $2 billion short of a pledge it made during the Obama administration to a UN Green Climate Fund.
Climate finance will definitely be one of the big expectations that the developing world will be placing in the U.S.'s new administration.
There's another big promise the world is waiting for, a pledge for how much the U.S. will cut carbon emissions in the next decade. Here's Claire Healy again.
We're expecting a 2030 target, like UK and Europe have. By how much is the United States going to reduce its emissions by 2030?
The U.S. set an older target under the Obama administration that it is now overshooting because the main policy aimed at meeting it was then reversed by the Trump administration. And here's that whiplash problem again. To combat it, Healy says what the U.S. needs is climate legislation.
The U.K. has a climate law. The European Union is working on its climate law. If you can legislate, then that signals to the world this is more durable. It's not going to fall at the first political hurdle.
Whether any legislation is possible in a closely divided Senate remains to be seen. Republican Senator Ted Cruz has already criticized Biden for rejoining the Paris Pact. But some domestic progress is essential for Biden to make good on his promise of becoming a global climate leader again, especially when it comes to the relationship with China. Kelly Sims Gallagher is a professor of environmental policy at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
Before the United States can effectively engage with China, the most important thing is to get our own house in order. And we will need an intensive effort on domestic policy to be able to position ourselves to be influential in U.S. foreign policy.
It's about restoring American credibility on an issue that the U.S. and China used to work together on.
I don't think it's possible for the world to get on track without joint leadership from the United States and China.
Biden is already sending signals aimed domestically and abroad. He's created new high-level positions focused on climate change and appointed former Secretary of State John Kerry to one of them. Jen Austin is a former State Department official.
Establishing those very senior positions in the White House shows how high a priority it's going to be.
Austin has experience as a U.S. climate negotiator. She says buy-in from the very top helps diplomats get their jobs done.
It's not only that there's a few senior climate leaders, it's that climate has shown up as an issue in the discussions around nominations for the leadership of a whole bunch of important departments.
As President Biden starts making phone calls to foreign leaders tomorrow, climate change is expected, once again, to be on the agenda. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
In Baghdad today, two suicide bombings ripped through a crowded market. At least 32 people were killed and dozens more wounded. It had been more than 3 years since Baghdad faced a suicide bombing like this. This attack comes, obviously, on the first full day of the Biden presidency. We wanted to look at how his administration is going to approach Iraq and what changes in U.S. policy we might see. Abbas Kadim is director of the Iraq Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Abbas, I just want to understand, first of all, how had Iraqis been feeling prior to the attack, and what does today's horror change for them?
It is sad news to see this and wake up in the morning for this kind of news. But also to put it in perspective, it is an indicator that this is an anomaly. This is abnormal. And Baghdad, as for a long time, has been safe but never really completely immune to any kind of security incidents like these.
So I'm really curious to know your thoughts on just what President Biden is facing in Iraq. If you had to characterize the situation that he's inherited there, what would you say? Are the problems still fundamentally connected to Washington? And if so, what's Biden's responsibility to the government in Baghdad?
The past administration has left some challenges on the security and also on the political fronts. And then the Iraqi-U.S.-Iranian conflict that has manifested itself mostly on Iraqi soil has been a big challenge for the bilateral relations. Having a U.S.-Iraqi policy that is attached to the U.S.-Iran policy has been a problem for the U.S.-Iraq relations. I think decoupling these two policies would help, and this would be probably an advisable thing for the Biden administration to do.
Obviously, not everyone in Iraq wants a continued U.S. presence there. Can you talk a bit about the fault lines that exist within Iraqi politics and how various militias there are exerting pressure on the U.S. to leave in a significant way?
Well, this is a problem not just for the United States. It's a problem for the Iraqi government. Often in my commentary say that Iraqis need to have an Iraqi-Iraqi dialogue regarding the nature and shape of the U.S.-Iraqi relations. Of course, much of what the problems that the Iraqi government is facing is because there are many entities in Iraq that have alliances, regional alliances with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other countries in the region, and those relations and the meddling of these countries in Iraqi affairs, mostly by proxies through Iraqi actors, do hinder the Iraqi government's ability to adopt a logical relationship with the United States and logical approach to the U.S.-Iraqi relations.
There is a big worry, though, that with elements of ISIS slipping quietly back into towns and cities across Iraq that they'd been pushed from, they're now regrouping. So do you think today's attack signifies a return to the violence that we witnessed at the height of ISIS's power in Iraq?
Acts like those disturb the peace. They keep the population anxious. The Iraqi government needs to reshape its approach towards combating terrorism right now by putting more emphasis on prevention, on intelligence capabilities, and also keep the security forces well prepared and performing to the best of their abilities. It is not a disheartening strategic problem, but certainly it is a tragic reminder to us that terrorism is a fact of life, not just in Iraq, but everywhere else.
Abbas Kadim is the director of the Iraq Initiative at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
President Biden wasted no time redecorating the Oval Office. One prominent addition behind the Resolute Desk, a bust of the civil rights and farm labor leader, Cesar Chavez. To explain the symbolism of this is Ricardo Sandoval. He's the public editor at PBS, and along with his wife, fellow journalist Susan Farris, the author of The Fight in the Fields, Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Movement. So it seems every time President Biden will be sitting at his desk, we'll see that image of Cesar Chavez behind him. How significant is this, and what was your reaction when you saw it?
It represents Biden's commitment to a community that I think helped him tremendously during this last campaign. You know, he's closely allied with the UFW.
United Farm Workers.
The UFW turned out for him, not just in California, but also helped organize in many other states. And Latinos were instrumental in turning Arizona for Biden this past November. It's a long history of a relationship between the Democratic Party and the UFW. And I know Biden is close to Dolores Huerta. And so I think it's a natural outgrowth of that relationship that you would have that finally in the White House, in the Oval Office.
Dolores Huerta, of course, another great labor rights leader. This move has gotten a lot of praise, the bust of Chavez, but there's also been criticism from people who point to Chavez's complicated history of denouncing undocumented immigrants. How do you read that?
Yeah, you know, that's a natural outgrowth, I think, of comments that he made at the time. Now, you remember, this was back in the 60s and 70s when he, on a couple of occasions, pushed back against the use by farmers of undocumented laborers to break strikes. So I think his comments at the time reflected that discouragement. But, you know, in the conversations I had with him and the conversations that Susan had with him, he never once disparaged his people in that manner. And I think that since then, especially in the last 20 to 25 years, you can see that the UFW and the farm workers movement has been at the forefront of trying to gain legitimacy and citizenship for this class of formerly undocumented workers and current undocumented workers and bring them into society and out of the shadows.
You're a biographer of Chavez, Ricardo. You're also a Mexican-American journalist who's written about the harmful impact of the last administration's racist rhetoric on immigrants. In that sense, what does this statue symbolize in your mind?
it's a significant change, and it's almost overnight. So it's a bit hard to believe yet. I think a lot of us are pinching ourselves and wondering, okay, is this the time for change now? Listen, I'm also a realist. I'm a veteran journalist, and I've been around the block a few times. So I know that this is not the immediate arrival of comprehensive immigration reform or an immediate change to the way that many people in the United States view Latino immigrants. It's a long history of conflict, but I think a long history of simultaneous progress. So I think this is a recognition of the Latino place in U.S. society.
Ricardo Sandoval, the author, along with Susan Ferris, of The Fight in the Fields, Cesar Chavez and the Farmworkers Movement. Thank you very much, Ricardo, for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hundreds of thousands of people in India have gotten vaccinated against the coronavirus, but it hasn't been all smooth sailing. As one newspaper headline put it, one half vaccinates, the other vacillates. Sandeep Roy has this report from Kolkata.
In Bengaluru, in South India, Dr. Giridhar R. Babu is waiting for his shot. Dr. Babu is the head of Life Course Epidemiology at the Public Health Foundation of India. He says he's entered all his details, but no appointment yet.
Apparently in the system, my name is not there, even after giving details.
The process started with great fanfare as trucks carrying the COVID vaccine rolled out of the Serum Institute of India. Coconuts were broken for good luck. India needs all the luck. Virologist Gagandeep Kang says this is a mammoth endeavor.
Remember, this is going to be something we have never done before. We've never had campaigns to immunize adults across the country before. We've never had a campaign that targets by occupation.
Amitava Ray, a neurosurgeon in Hyderabad, feels the process has been very professionally organized.
You download the app, they take your ID, they scan you in, they give it to you, you go and you wait for half an hour. There is a waiting area.
In the first 3 days alone, India has managed to vaccinate just over 381,000 people. The good news is, only a handful have been hospitalized with side effects. The bad news is, the target for the first day alone was 300,000. India should be well prepared to roll out a vaccine on a mass scale, says Dr. Babu.
Because when the world said we can't eradicate polio, India did that.
But that was bottom-up, with micro-plans going up from the village level. This has been more top-down. The government wants to coordinate the whole process through an app called CoWin. But software glitches meant many people didn't get notified about their appointments till too late. Healthcare workers are doing manual entry and then uploading data later, says Dr. Babu.
They seem to be doing double the work.
Some places are getting around software glitches by inking the fingers of the vaccinated, the way India marks the fingers of those who vote. Also, there are two vaccines on offer. Covishield by the University of Oxford with pharma company AstraZeneca, and the entirely indigenous Covaxin, which is still in phase 3 clinical trial. Some doctors are complaining they are not being given a choice. Dr. Ray says there's hesitancy because doctors read the clinical trial data.
The trial has changed midway through. It was going to be one shot. Now, apparently, now it is two shots. Then the second shot was half, and now it is full. It was 21 days apart. Now they say it's 3 months apart.
So many want to wait and watch because being vaccinated won't mean they can let down their guard. It's possible they can still give the virus to unvaccinated friends, family, and patients.
I've been doing this for almost a year now, wearing a mask, and it's become second nature to me. So why not wait for 6 weeks to see exactly how it pans out before we take the vaccine?
India wants to vaccinate 300 million people by July. 30 million healthcare and frontline workers and 270 million who are older or have comorbidities like diabetes. Beyond the startup problems and technological hiccups, the real challenge lies ahead, says Harsh Mandar, a social worker. The virus has already exposed the harsh inequities in India. For people without a proper home or access to running water, the messages about hand washing and physical distancing ring hollow. Mandar says infections are rising among the destitute and the homeless.
We will continue to be in a mirage that people like you and I in the middle class and the rich will get access to the vaccines and we'll get protected. Are we going to reach that most vulnerable, that last person with the vaccine?
That's why Dr. Babu says he's neither excited nor nervous as he waits his turn. He's not nervous because he believes it's safe. And he'll be excited when most Indians can get the vaccine. He says, that's when we can say, okay, we did it. For The World, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
In Spain, life just got a little better for new fathers. Spain has raised the length of paternity leave to 16 weeks, the same amount of time given to new mothers, one of just a few countries now with equity in that department. In Spain, it's not just about more time off. The idea is to push men to take a more active role in their children's lives. A noble goal, but a lot of people say this move won't be enough to challenge accepted gender roles. From Barcelona, Lucia Benavides has our story.
Every Friday, Maria Gallardo and Francesc Turmo pick up their kids from school together. Today, their youngest, 3-year-old Martí, runs to his mom as soon as he sees her.
Martí!
A few moments later, 5-year-old Mia comes out and hugs her dad, then asks for her mom. While the family waits for 7-year-old Alex to get out of his capoeira class, they go to a nearby plaza where dozens of children have thrown their backpacks aside and swarmed the playground. Some have picked up a game of soccer. For Gallardo and Turmo, it was important from the very start to share childcare duties. That's why Turmo took as much paternity leave as he could for each child.
Con el primero, yo tuve 4 meses y él tuvo 2 semanas.
They say that with their first child, Turmo was only able to take 2 weeks paid leave. With their second child, he was able to take 3. With the third, he managed a whole month off. That's because paternity leave has been progressively increasing. Starting this year, men have 4 months of federally mandated paid leave, the same as women. It's paid for entirely by the Spanish government at 100% of their salary. That puts Spain ahead of many European countries, where even places like Sweden pay men only 80% of their salary for paternity leave. Turmo says this is an important step forward.
Lo que veo muy positivo de esto es que luego el hombre...
He says it's a good thing that men are able to stay with their child after the mom has returned to work. He has many friends who are already taking advantage of it. The new law in Spain is a result of over a decade of lobbying from the organization Platform for Equal and Non-Transferable Birth and Adoption Leave. Spokesperson Maria Pasos says the idea was to push men to take a more active role in childcare and ensure better work opportunities for women. She says companies are less likely to discriminate against the gender of an employee if every person is guaranteed the same amount of leave.
Cuando a los hombres se les concede un permiso para cuidar a sus criaturas que esté
When you give men paternity leave and it's well paid, they take it and they get involved in childcare.
But Paso says the law isn't exactly what the organization had proposed. That is, non-transferable paid leave for men to take separately from their female partners. The law requires fathers to take the first 6 weeks in conjunction with the mother, and the last 10 weeks, which can be taken part-time, to be arranged with their employers.
It undermines the purpose of a paternity leave and ultimately pressures fathers to take their entire leave alongside the mother's, or to take it when it's most convenient to their company.
Paso says the idea behind a non-transferable leave is to ensure men take it. If it were transferable, she says, they would likely hand it over to their female partners instead. But sociologist Gracia Trujillo from the Complutense University of Madrid says only a small percentage of fathers take their paternity leave, and that's not likely to change with the new law.
Hasta ahora, los varones que querían cuidar...
Until now, men who wanted to take care of their children had the option of taking paternity leave or leave of absence. So if you really want to be involved in your child's life, you don't need the government to give you 4 months off. This law is being implemented in the name of equality, But the reality is that caretaker duties still aren't equal.
Trujillo says that changing the law won't change gender roles. Women continue to be the primary caretakers, so they're the ones who need more paid time off, she says. Or it should at least be transferable, she adds, so that couples can decide for themselves how to best distribute the time.
This is one small part of a larger discussion about vulnerability, about caretaking duties, and about who takes on those roles. Historically, it's been women, and it's a job that hasn't been valued. That needs to change radically.
The key, says Trujillo, is having a parental leave that centers around the well-being of those who need care. In this case, the child. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Before I leave you today with a fresh new musical groove, you need the backstory to it. A backstory about the sample that informed the groovy track I'm talking about. The sample comes from a 1970s funk band from Roosevelt, Long Island, New York. The now defunct Lafayette Afro Rock Band were innovators and little known in the US in the 70s. The funk scene was too crowded here, so they moved to Paris, where they dipped into a slightly different style. This saxophone phrase from their track, Darkest Light, is swirling and hypnotic with not much funk to it, but has been sampled a lot by the likes of Jay-Z and Public Enemy. And now Texas-based DJ and producer El Dusty, along with some of his collaborators, have worked the Darkest Light sample into a cumbia track called Sax Rhythm. Here comes the sample. New York funk, French rock, Afrobeat, and finally, Latin cumbia. It takes a global village and some time to brew a sound like this. We leave you with more from El Dusty and Co. and their new track, Sax Rhythm. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. If you miss us here, don't forget we're online 24/7 at theworld.org. Stay safe, be strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.